monitors not being used, we can adjust those later. And you're free to ask questions by email at any time, although you couldn't necessarily expect, you know, instantaneous response. So in general, I guess you're welcome to ask those questions, whether you're, you know, taking the class for credit or auditing. So it's supposed to be a communal thing. Anyway, so before we get started, I wrote up here some of the stuff from last time, although I guess I now blocked it partially. Because we're going to be using the polygroup a lot today. But before I get started on the new stuff, I should ask, are there any questions on the problem set or on stuff we did last time? How do people find the problem set? Is it hard, easy?
Hard.
Any other opinions? Medium hard. Too long, too short. Well, we'll see next week after the second problem set how you react to this one, and we can maybe start to get some reasonable statistics. So, but there are no questions on last time. Okay. So then, in that case, maybe let's get started with new stuff. So one point, since this is being recorded, there are hanging mics to catch your questions. But, you know, since they're kind of spread throughout the room, if you don't speak loudly, it doesn't show up very well in the recording. So try to remember, if you're asking a question, to speak up. Unless, of course, you're so embarrassed that you don't want anybody to hear it. In that case, why are you really asking?
If someone asked, just repeat, to be honest with you, because I feel nothing.
Well, that's right. So I can try to remember repeat, but I might forget. And of course, it's not always immediately obvious standing up here which questions are going to be audible and which ones are not. Anyway, so to get started, last time, remember, we talked about errors, different types of quantum errors at the beginning, and then we talked about quantum error correcting codes. In particular, I showed you the non-qubit code, which was capable of correcting those errors. So what I'd like to do now is discuss a more general framework for talking about quantum codes. It's not going to incorporate every kind of quantum code. Whereas the quantum error correcting conditions I talked about at the end of last time do, in fact, apply to every quantum error correcting code. But it's a nice class of code because it has a lot of useful properties. And maybe you got in the first problem last time asked you to compute the quantum error correction conditions for the 9-qubit code. And maybe you thought that problem was a little bit tedious. So one advantage of this new group of codes that I'll be showing you is that it's a lot more efficient to think about, well, properties of the codes and whether or not it is a quantum error correction code. Okay, so to motivate this thing, let's think about the 9-qubit code again and start to write down the various things we have to measure in order to figure out the error syndrome of any particular error. Well, let's write the 9-qubit code again. So we have 0 is 3 copies of this thing. And 1, 3 copies of this thing. 0, 0, 0, minus 1. First, what do we do to figure out where the bit flips are? Well, we treat each group of 3 as kind of repetition code, right? And remember what we did to figure out where the error was in the repetition code. We said, are the first 2 qubits the same or different, and are the second 2 qubits the same or different? And we're going to do that in this case for each set of 3. Well, so how do we tell if the first 2 qubits are the same or different? Well, we measure their parity, whether they're both 0, both 1, even or odd. Even being both 0, both 1, odd being different. But let's try to frame that in terms of a more quantum way. using the Pauli matrices. Well, the operator z has eigenvalues plus 1 and minus 1 for 0 and 1. So z tensor z will have eigenvalue plus 1 if the two qubits are both 0 or both 1, right? Because we'll get either plus 1 squared or minus 1 squared. And I'll have eigenvalue minus 1 if they're opposite, right? If 1 is 0 and 1 is 1. So let's write that down. So for the first three qubits, we want to measure z tensor I. And I tensor z. And the correct code words could have eigenstate plus 1 for both of these operators. Right? That's just a restatement of what I just said. And, well, of course, we can do the same thing for the other sets of three. And I hope you'll forgive me if I don't write out all the other six I's in each of these rows. Okay? But each row represents one operator for which the original code words, the correct code words, have an eigenvalue plus 1. And what's more, these are operators that we measure in order to figure out what the error signature is. Right? These two tell us where the bit flips are in the first set of three, these two in the second set of three, and these two in the third set of three. Okay. So what about the phase errors? Well, the phase errors, we want to compare the signs to see if they're the same or different again, right? So the correct one should have the same sign, plus, 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 or minus, minus, minus. So by analogy, we should say, well, what we want to do is we want to measure whether the first two signs are the same or different, right? Whether they're both plus or both minus. So how do we do that? Well, instead of using z's this time, we'll have to use the x's up there. I drifted up again. So how do we do that? Well, an x is a bit flip. So if we do just one bit flip, we're not going to get back to anything like what we started. But if we do three bit flips on the set of three, well, that'll take 0, 0, 0 to 1, 1, 1, and 1, 1, 1 to 0, 0, 0. So it'll take 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1 to itself, and 0, 0, 0 minus 1, 1, 1 to minus itself, right? So if we do three bit flips on two sets of three, we should either get two plus signs or two minus signs on the original code word states. Right? But one of them is plus. If one of them is plus and one of them is minus, then we'll get one plus sign and one minus sign. So this operator with six x's should have eigenvalue plus one for the code word states. And it tells us whether the first two signs are the same or different. Does everyone see that? Okay, good. And this operator with six x's on qubits 4 through 9, tells us whether the second two signs are the same or different. Okay? So by measuring the two eigenvalues of these operators, we can then tell where our sign flip error is. Okay? Everyone happy with that? Okay, so here we have eight operators. And these operators can tell us the error syndrome of the code, of the error that occurs on this code by measuring their eigenvalues. So this list of operators suggests a definition that we could use in a more general case. So in this case, what we did was we wrote down a bunch of operators, all of which have eigenvalue plus 1 for the correct code words. So let's try that. These are all Pauli operators. That's what makes it. Pauli operators have nice properties, so that's what makes it nice to do that. Let's make the same definition in general. So we'll have T is a quantum error correcting code. Oh, that's nice. And we'll define a set, S of t, of poly operators, so a set of p and p sub n, such that p has eigenvalue plus 1 for all code words, for all states in the subspace. Okay? So S of t is called the stabilizer. Okay, stabilizer because the operators leave things fixed, stable. So of course, there's no reason from what I've written so far that you'd think, well, why are we only choosing poly operators, right? We could choose general unitary operators. You can get kind of a unitary stabilizer rather than a poly stabilizer. But it turns out, because the poly operators have special properties, that this is a very useful thing to look at. And in fact, in a lot of cases, this is enough to define the code, the original subspace D. Not in every case, but in kind of the most interesting codes, or most of the most interesting codes. That's true. Okay, so what properties does this stabilizer have? Well, so one fairly obvious thing is the stabilizer is closed under multiplication. It's a group. So why is that? Well, p psi is equal to psi. So if p and q are an S, that implies that p times q applied to psi. Well, q psi is equal to psi, so this is equal to p times psi. And this is equal to psi. Right? So pq also has eigenvalue plus 1. This is true for all psi and t. So pq is also an S of t. Right? Okay. A little less obvious. S of t is not just a group, it's an abelian group. Why is that? Well, for those who have some physics background, you'll perhaps remember that in general you can't simultaneously measure operators unless they commute. There are kind of cases in which you can, but in this case that's going to be the right condition. And remember, we want to have here a subspace which has simultaneous eigenvalues for all of these operators, so they should commute. So we can prove that very easily, in fact. So again, we have PQ in the stabilizer. And, well then, by this argument, pq psi is equal to psi. And of course, the same argument shows that qp psi is equal to psi. So that implies that the commutator of p and q, which is pq minus qp, annihilates psi. Okay? So this doesn't, for general operators, this doesn't tell you that they commute. But the poly operators, so here we're using one of those properties. They have the property that either they commute or they anti-commute, any two of them. And if you work out the possibility when they anti-commute, you'll get something unitary, something that doesn't have a zero eigenvalue. So in the case of poly operators, this really implies that they do commute.
But that definition will be satisfied for any psi. Wouldn't that imply that there's...
Well, it's only, yes, if that were true for all psi in Hilbert space. But this is only true for all psi in T, remember, which is a subspace of the full Hilbert space.
So you sort of claim that it's sort of abelian, like any operator system, well, has abelian on the subspace.
That's right. So that would be the general case for general operators. But in the case of polys, you can actually say they really commute on the whole subspace. Good question. Other questions? Okay. And there's another property which is also an obvious one, almost too obvious to write down, but it still has to be done. Minus 1 is not in S, right? Because minus 1 has only eigenvalues of minus 1. And therefore, it can't be in, have a plus 1 eigenvalue. Okay? And this is actually helpful because it rules out, well, it means that maybe the more interesting thing is that it means, so when I define this, I'm only saying polyoperators. So I'm not saying anything about phases. So it could be that you have, you know, minus x, or minus x tensor x, something like that, in the stabilizer. That's a perfectly valid thing to think stabilizer. But what this condition says is you can't have both minus x tensor x and plus tensor x, plus x tensor x in the stabilizer, right? So whenever you have one polyoperator, you don't have another one with a different phase that's also in the stabilizer. So that's an important thing to remember. It's very useful. And then here's another property that follows from 1, 2, and 3. Because we're talking about polyoperators, we now know that the size of this group S of T has to be a power of 2. Why is that? Well, poly is squared either plus 1 or minus 1. The case where it's squared minus 1 is when you have a phase of I out front. But if you have a phase of I out front, then when you square that, you get minus 1. Minus 1 is not an S of T. So we only have things that are squared at plus 1. So since they're abelian, what we can do is we can just list a set of operators in the stabilizer. And we can think of them as independent operators if we really list them in order, and the next one can't be written as a product of any of the previous ones. Right? And once we've done that, well, we can just say any element in the stabilizer is a product of these generators that we've written down. So there are generators, M1 through MR, and the general element is of the form M1 to the A1, M2 to the A2, etc. Right, and A, the AIs are plus or minus 1. Sorry. 0 or 1. It's a different set of order 2. Right, and that gives us the most general element of the stabilizer. And this tells us that the size of this thing is 2 to the R. Okay.
I'm confused. What do the generators do?
So the generators are this kind of set of minimal elements that we can write down, where we can take products of them and get everything in the group.
So those are tensor products down there?
No, this is product, group product.
Oh.
So going back to this 9-qubit code, what I've written down here is actually a set of generators for the stabilizer of the 9-qubit code, right? Because of course, these aren't the only things that have this property that the code words are plus one eigenstates, right? For instance, we take the product of this and this, we get ZIZ. And we can see that the first and the third qubits will also always have even character. Right? So it's inconvenient to have to write all of these 2 to the R elements. And in fact, you don't have to because these generators kind of define the whole group. Not kind of define, they do define the whole group. Okay? So that's already one advantage we have by looking at the stabilizer, that instead of having to look at all these 2 to the R elements, we just have to look at the R generators. Okay? And if you think about the structure of the poly group, you'll find that the biggest possible abelian subgroup you can have in the poly group has 2 to the n elements. So in fact, this R has to be less or equal to n.
Still don't get where the 2 to the R comes from.
Yeah, so the point is that by properties 1 through 3, we can write everything in terms in this format I wrote, M1 to the A1, M2 to the A2, through MR to the AR. Okay, and once we do that, we can say that there's actually only 2 to the RL.
Yeah, okay.
Because I was unclear about what the cause and what was the effect of that.
So Daniel, I mean, from the fact that P squared for every poly operator is an entity, we can think that none of these A have to be more than...
Than 1, that's right.
Yeah,
0, 1.
Yeah, but why is it that every such thing gives me a different... So that helps us...
Right, the point is we choose these generators to be independent, so that none of them can be written, none of these R generators can be written as a product of the other R generators. So that means that whenever we add a new element, it has to be... adding those products has to be new. You can just, these are all invertible things, right? So you can just verify that straightforwardly. Other questions? Okay. So these are the properties that if we have a subspace and we write down a stabilizer, then we'll get a group with these properties. Well, being a group is one of the properties. But it turns out that it's actually usually very helpful to go the other way, to write down a group and define a code from it. So how do we do that? So we have a parallel definition. So we're going to let S be something that satisfies those properties. So it's an abelian subgroup of the poly group. And it's not going to contain -1. And so then we define the code space of S to be a subspace T of S of state psi on these n qubits, such that, well, it's kind of the symmetric definition here, such that P psi is equal to psi for all P in the stabilizer. Right? So before we were defining the set of all poly operators which have +1 eigenstate for all code words, and now we're defining the set of vectors, state vectors, that have +1 eigenstate for all poly operators in the stabilizer. Okay? So then we say that that this is a stabilizer code. So sometimes you say that the subspace of the Hilbert space is the stabilizer code. Sometimes we just say the group itself is a stabilizer code. And sometimes you can go further and just the list of the generators, which defines the group. And the reason is that all of these things are equivalent. You can go from one to the other. But this is only true, there is kind of an asymmetry here. So if you start with S and then take the code subspace of it, and then take the stabilizer of the code subspace, you get back the original thing. So S is equal to S of T of S. So using that definition for S of T, and this definition for T of S. But it's not always true that T is equal to T of S of T. So if you take a general subspace of the Hilbert space, and you take the stabilizer of it, and then you take the code subspace of that, you might get something bigger than the original subspace. Okay. Yeah. Say again.
Do you have an example?
Do I have an example of this not being true?
Yeah.
Well, it's easy to come up with examples, but I'd rather leave that to you to figure out. For almost any subspace, in fact, it's not going to be true. So, in some sense, these stabilizer codes are very special subspaces of Hilbert space. But if you just write down one at random, you'll see it's not true. And as I'll get to very soon, you'll see that there are certain properties that make it clear that that's true. At least, well, yeah. So one property is that these things can only have very certain dimensions. It has to be a power of 2. So that already tells you that there's a lot of spaces for it. Okay, so these stabilizer codes have some other names in the literature relating to kind of different representations of this, of them. So sometimes you say it's called a symplectic code, or an additive code, or sometimes an additive GF4 code. So we'll get to all of the reasons for this. This one maybe next time, this one probably later today. But mostly this reflects, it reflects kind of different history in some sense of how these are derived. Right, so are there other questions on this? So the 9-qubit code, of course, it's not immediately obvious since we haven't derived all the conditions, but the 9-qubit code is actually an example of one of these stabilizer codes. So it's one of the cases although we started from the code words, we could have started from the stabilizer and gotten back these same code words. Okay. So what properties do these stabilizer codes have? So there's kind of two obvious properties we might ask about for quantum Hilbert-correcting code. And of course, the motivation of this is to consider quantum Hilbert-correcting codes. So the first one is how many qubits does it encode? What's the dimension of the encoded Hilbert space? So I just told you that was a power of 2. And in fact, you can get it just by counting the number of generators and number of qubits. The dimension is 2 to the n minus r. So that's number of qubits equals n minus r. So I'm going to put off proving this to you, but it's kind of a very intuitive statement. Because if you think about it, each time we add a new Pauli operator, like one of these 8 things, we're putting a constraint on the allowed Hilbert space. Right? If we have no Pauli operator, we could have the whole Hilbert space. If we have one Pauli operator, well, it has eigenvalues plus 1 and minus 1. So it splits the Hilbert space in half. So now the dimension of the subspace is 2 to the n minus 1. And then if we add another Pauli operator, well, it splits it in half again. So the dimension of what's allowed, still allowed, is 2 to the n minus 2, and so on. And when you put r constraints on it, you've divided it in half r times. So you divide it by 2 to the r. And what's left is a dimension 2 to the n minus r. That's not a proof, of course, because you don't know that you're actually dividing in half each time. Maybe somehow these things can conspire so that sometimes you're dividing in 3/4. The dividing part that you have left in 3/4, but the other part is divided in a slightly larger or a slightly smaller section. But I will prove it. And you can see that from 9-qubit code, this works, right? There's 8 generators and 9 qubits. So there's one encoded qubit. Here's what we have. Okay. And the second obvious property you can ask about is, well, what errors can this code correct? So it turns out actually to be easier to say which ones it can detect. I don't know how to phrase this. So let's define a set n of s, which is also sometimes written s perf like this, which is the set of Pauli operators that commute with everything in the stabilizer. Okay, so why do we look at this? Well, going back to this equation, to this non-qubit code, we saw that these first six operators were used to tell us the error synchron for where the bit flip errors are, right, the x's. And these things down here, the ones with six x's, were used to tell us where the phase errors were, right? So the interesting property here is that the z's tell us where the x's are, and the x's tell us where the z's are. And x and z anti-commute. So that turned out to be the general property we want. We want to look for things that anti-commute to detect errors. So these are kind of a set of undetectable errors. So the theorem is that s can detect errors outside n of s minus s. And the minus s is a very interesting, there's a very interesting reason for that, which we'll get to in a minute. So another way of saying this, well, no, so this is the general statement. But in particular, if we're interested in the distance of the code, which we defined last time, then the distance is the minimum of something in this undetectable set. Minimum weight p in s minus this. Okay. So you remember that the minimum distance was equal to the smallest weight of a Pauli operator that we couldn't detect. That was one way of defining the minimum distance. And so that's the motivation for this connection here. Okay, so again, we'll talk in a little more detail about this in a second. But basic statement of the theorem, okay? Okay, so the proof of A is going to require a little more formalism, so let's do proof of B first. Oh, but do I want to... Oh, yeah, okay, good. So, okay, so there's some notation I didn't get a chance to define last time. So, for a quantum error-correcting code that has distance d, we'd like some way to kind of incorporate the basic properties, how many encoded qubits, and the distance, and number of physical qubits. So if we have a quantum error-correcting code with k-dimensional subspace, encoded subspace, n physical qubits, and distance d, we write that this way, nkd with double parentheses. And the double parentheses are used to indicate that it's a quantum error correcting code, whereas classical error correcting codes are used with single parentheses. For a stabilizer code, so a stabilizer code has to have encoded dimension that's a power of 2. So this big K doesn't have to be a power of 2. So we write it as 2 to the little k. And then instead of using parentheses, we use square brackets. So n, k, d, like this. OK? Is that notation clear?
Are those big k's or small k's inside the brackets in both?
Sorry, so this is a big k, and this is a small k. Okay, so incorporating the fact that the general quantum error correcting code doesn't have to have a dimension that's a power, encoded dimension that's a power of 2, whereas the stabilizer code does. Okay. Okay, so let's prove part B, which is in some sense harder, but in some sense more straightforward. Straightforward in the sense that it doesn't require any more formalism. Okay, so let's see what happens if we do have an error that anti-commutes with something that's stabilizer. So we have something in stabilizer and poly operator such that these two anti-commute. And suppose P is an error that happens to the state. Okay? Well, what happens? Let's measure the eigenvalue of M. Well, this is MP, which by the anti-commutation we can right is minus pm. And m is in the stabilizer, so m psi is equal to psi. So this is equal to minus p psi. In other words, whereas psi was a plus 1 eigenvalue of m, p psi is a minus 1 eigenvalue. So minus 1 eigenstate. So it's not in the code, and moreover, it's orthogonal to the code. And we even know how to tell that it's orthogonal, just by measuring the eigenvalue of m. Okay? On the other hand, let's suppose it's the other way. We have some p in the poly group that commutes with everything that's stabilized. So in other words, p is in this set n of s. But what then? Well then, for any m in the stabilizer, if we do the same calculation, we'll find, well, m p psi is equal to p m psi, which is equal to p psi. So in other words, p psi is a plus 1 eigenstate for all m in stabilizer. And p psi is therefore in this code space. Okay? So if psi was a valid code word, which I guess is what we've assumed here, then p psi is still a valid code word. In other words, p is something that takes code words to code words. And there's no way we could detect such an error, right? Because we don't know if the original state was psi or was p psi. right? So that's something that would be very bad. Except, so P is undetectable. Except, there's a possibility that it's not an error at all, because it might be that P psi is equal to psi. But of course, for this to be OK, it has to be true for all psi, because otherwise there would be some things on which it was an error and some things which it's not an error, which means we could still consider it an error, right? Because some states it will ruin. Okay? So, but if this is true, if P psi is equal to psi for all psi in T of S, then this P is not doing anything. It's not taking, I mean, it's taking valid code words to valid code words, but it's the same valid code words. It's not an error. It's just doing nothing. Okay? And this is exactly the condition that P is in S. Okay? So the upshot, well, if we have an error that's outside N of S, so that's this case, then that means we can detect it. If we have an error that's inside N of S, but outside, well, so if we have an error that's inside N of S and it's actually inside S, then it's not an error. It's not doing anything to the code words. It might be doing things to states that are not in the code space. In fact, it generally will if P is a non-trivial operation. But for the valid code words, it's not doing anything. So we don't think of that as an error, and so we think of it as, well, we can. It's not. It's certainly not an undetectable error. It's not. It's undetectable, but it's not an error. And then we have the intermediate case, the bad case, where it's an N of S but not an S. And that's what the theorem says, that those are the undetectable errors. Okay? And again, we can define the distance as the smallest, the weight of the smallest undetectable error. Okay? Maybe I'll use this word again. So this property that we have errors which we don't have to detect because they don't do anything, because they're in the stabilizer, that's a kind of interesting property that's unique to quantum error parsing code. This is the phenomenon of degeneracy, which is the other thing I didn't get a chance to talk about last time. Degeneracy is not just for stabilizer codes, it's for general quantum error correcting codes. And in the general case, in a non-degenerate code, we should have that linearly independent errors go to linearly independent states. Whereas in a degenerate code, linearly independent errors can take us to states that are linearly dependent. And we saw an example of that on the problem set with a 9-qubit code, and I'll show you that in just a second. So let's write down this definition. So QECC is degenerate set of errors. So I guess I could say that. Linearly independent set of errors. So if this matrix CAB that appears in the quantum error correcting conditions does not have maximum rank, and then we just say it's degenerate. If it's degenerate, for E as the set of poly operators which the code would normally be able to correct. So if the code has distance 2t plus 1, it should be able to correct errors of up to weight t. And we say that it's a degenerate code if this condition is true, that the matrix CAB has non-maximal rank for errors of up to that weight. In other words, the errors that we want to be able to correct, the errors of up to size t, we get this case where we have linearly independent errors that give us dependent states. So for instance, we could have two errors that do the same thing. And that's what happened in the case of the 9-qubit code. Right? If we look at, say, the phase flip z on the first qubit versus the phase flip z on the second qubit, we get the same state, right? 0,0,0 plus 1,1,1 versus 0,0,0 minus 1,1,1 in either case. Right? There's no way to distinguish z1 and z2. But we don't need to because they give us the same state. That's why the quantum error correction conditions were still satisfied. And if you did the problem set and you diagonalized that matrix CAB, you'll find that it had zero eigenvalues, right? It has non-maximal rank. And in general, the way this degeneracy condition can appear for stabilizer code is when we have this happening. So in particular, if we have two errors that we should be able to correct, EA and EB, where the product is in a stabilizer, then the stabilizer code is degenerate. Okay, and we can again see that in the case of the 9-qubit code, right? So for instance, we had z1 and z2. They were degenerate in the sense that they had the same operation on the code space. Well, and z1 times z2 is in the stabilizer, right? Similarly, z2 times z3, because we can't distinguish between bit flips on the second and third qubit. We also can't distinguish between bit flips on between phase flips on the first qubit and the third qubit. And well, that's not one of the generators, but as I said before, it's a product of two of these generators. So it's still in the stabilizer group. Okay. But for other stabilizer codes, you don't have this happening. And everything is larger. The other way this occurs is, so if we have this minimum distance up there, that's the minimum weight of something in n of s minus s. Well, in a non-degenerate code, non-degenerate stabilizer code, the distance is actually equal to the minimum weight in n of s, right? Because the only thing that's trivial in the stabilizer then is the identity. Say, stabilizer group, right? So the identity is always in it, which is clear because the identity has plus one eigenvalue for everything, not just the code. People understand this. So there are questions. Different way of saying the same question. I guess not quite the same. could be you don't understand but still don't have questions, or that you do understand and have questions. Either one is okay. But I prefer if you have questions. Yeah?
Can you explain to me what the zero eigenvalue would mean in the CAB?
Right. So, so the way I'm saying it about degeneracy, what it means is that you have two operators where the difference of them is zero. In other words, so there's two operators doing the same thing to the code space. But another way of thinking about it is, well, you can look at this linear combination operator, and then you have a code, then you have an operator that annihilates code words. In other words, this operator is something that occurs with zero probability, even though it's kind of allowed by its weight. Okay? So that's another way of thinking about it, is that there are operators that just can't occur on the subspace because they always have zero probability. Is that a good explanation? Maybe think about it some more. Other questions? Okay, maybe I'll go on then. Let's see, can I erase this 9-qubit plug in? Oh, let's go quicker. Okay, so, remember, when I originally presented the stabilizer for 9-qubit code, I did it by saying, well, these are the things that we measure to figure out the error signal. And so that's generally true, right? Because it thinks that anti-commute with m will change the eigenvalue of m from plus 1 to minus 1, we can, in general, for a stabilizer code, measure the error string from some general error p by measuring the eigenvalues of the generators of the stabilizer. So E is the error syndrome, which is an R bit vector, binary vector. And the ith bit of this is 0 if P commutes with MI, and it's 1 if P anti-commutes with MI. Where the MIs are the generators. Let's write this n minus k, right? Because there's n minus k generators. Okay? Does everyone understand that, right? So this error syndrome is basically the vector of eigenvalues. If this error p occurs, then, well, if it commutes with mi, mi will still have eigenvalue plus 1. If it anti-commutes with mi will have eigenvalue minus 1. Okay, so by measuring these r generators, n minus k generators, we get this vector of eigenvalues and therefore know the error syndrome, which is going to identify the error p. And in fact, it's worth noticing that if you have the product of two things, P and Q, then the syndrome of their product is going to be Well, since we've got to the 0-1 notation, it's going to be the sum of the vectors of the error syndromes for the two things that were multiplied. This is binary arithmetic. Right? And why is that? Well, so if so what happens is P takes a plus one eigenstate to a minus one eigenstate, but also goes the other way by the same argument. Takes a minus one eigenstate to a plus one eigenstate. So if P and Q both commute with MI, well, they'll both have syndrome bit 0, eigenvalue plus 1 all the way through, and so this is true. If they both have, they both anti-commute, then we'll go from plus to minus, and then minus back to plus when we do both P and Q. So again, it'll commute overall, and we'll have syndrome bit 0. And if one of them commutes and one of them anti-commutes, then we'll go to the minus 1 eigenvalue, and we'll have syndrome bit 1, 0 plus 1. Okay? And so this kind of allows us to put all the pieces together there, right? So if P and Q have the same error syndrome as each other, then the product P times Q is going to have error syndrome 0, which is saying that P times Q, let me write this down. Syndrome P equals syndrome Q. We're just saying that P times Q commutes with everything in the stabilizer, right? So that's saying that P times Q is in N of S. Right? So there's only two possibilities here. One of them is that it's actually in the stabilizer, in which case it's okay that the syndrome of P and the syndrome of Q are the same. We can't distinguish them because they do the same thing. The other possibility is that the product is in N of S, in which case it's bad that we can't distinguish them. That means that we won't know which error actually occurred, P or Q. Okay? So this is what allows us to convert back and forth from this idea of detecting things in outside N of S minus S, and correcting things whose products are outside N of S minus S. Okay, just as it was true for the general quantum error correction code, except that then we had to apply the quantum error correction conditions. Okay, questions on that? Okay. So, okay. So let's move on then. By proving part B. So to do that, I want to introduce a couple new ideas. So the first one is, well, okay. So how actually do you figure out? Looked it up. But given this definition for T of S, if somebody gives you the generators for a stabilizer S, or just S itself, the whole listing of things in it, how do you figure out T of S? Well, one way to do that is to write down the projector onto that subspace. So what is that projector? Well, okay, so what's the projector onto the plus one eigenspace of some general poly operator M? Let's call this a big projector. Projector on plus one eigenspace of M. Well, M has eigenvalues plus one and minus one. And we want to get rid of the minus one eigenvalues, minus one eigenstates, and keep the plus one eigenstates. So how do we do that? Well, if we look at this combination, I plus m, well, then minus one eigenstates will give us 0. Right? This is another one of those things that has, if you apply it to a minus one eigenstate, it will never occur. But of course, if you have a plus one eigenstate, we'll get 2 times I, so we can divide by 2 to get rid of that. And so what this does, if we take it on a general state, it'll project out into the plus one eigenspace. Right? And so the natural thing to do then to find pi of s is to do this for everything that's stabilized. Actually, we don't need to do everything that's stabilized. We just need to do the independent things, the generators. So that's what we'll do, is we'll take the product over m sub I, where the m sub I are generators of s. Of 1/2 times 1 plus mi. Right, so we can take this 1/2 out front, and this is 1 over 2 to the n minus k, number of generators. Or we can multiply this out. And what do we get when we multiply it out? Well, we get all possible combinations of products that either have an I or an mi in place I. Right? So in other words, we have something of this of the thing that's behind there, which was of the form m1 to the a1, m2 to the a2, etc., right? And each ai could be either 0, in the case we have an I, or 1, in the case we have mi. So in other words, when we multiply this out, we get every element of the stabilizer. So that's what this is equal to. This is equal to 1 over 2 to the n minus k times the sum over m, the stabilizer, of m. That's all. Okay? So if you apply this to any state, you'll get some state in the code space. I mean, it would be unnormalized, in fact, of course. Or you can just think of this as a density matrix of the code space, the projector in the code space, in a sense. Okay. So more notation. So in order to prove stuff about stabilizers, it's frequently helpful to kind of forget about these annoying phases of and think of them as an exercise in linear algebra. So for a general element in M, we can think of it as it's a product of xi's and zi's, right? So it might be, so if it has like x in the first position, that would be x1, and if it's y in the second position, that's x2 times z2. So what did I say, xi's and y's? Xi's and zi's, product of xi's and zi's. So it's x2 times z2. If it's I in the third position, well, it has no x3 or z3, and so on. And once we know the position of all those x's and z's, then we have m up to a phase. So what we're going to do is we're going to consider not m in Pn, but m in Pn modulo the phases. And we're going to represent it as 2 binary vectors. Okay? And to get this back, We take the ith bit of mx and the ith bit of mz to determine the ith poly in the tensor decomposition of M. So using kind of the obvious thing, if the ith bit of mx is 1 and the ith bit of mz is 0, then we have x and so on. Right? 0, 1 is z, 1, 1 is y, and 0, 0 is I. Okay? That decomposition makes sense? But unfortunately, if we do this and get rid of the phases, then we've kind of lost an important property, which is the commutation anti-commutation property. So it's true that the product in the poly group corresponds to the sum in the binary vector notation. Except that you don't have this issue of commutation and anti-commutation because you've gotten rid of the phases. So we need to kind of bring that back. And in particular, we can define this symplectic inner product and that's, so these are, Px is a vector, right, of an n-bit binary vector. And we take the dot product of that with Qz. And then we add in this is a dot product, so it gives us a bit. And we add in the bit we get by doing it the other way around. Qx dot Pz. Okay? So what we're doing is, let's think of that. Is we're taking this dot product and this dot product, right? And you can see, so when do these two vectors, when do these two poly operators commute with each other? Well, we can calculate that by looking at that same combination, right? We say, we count the number of times that this and this are both non-zero, because x's will anti-commute with z's. And then also the number of times that this and this are both non-zero. Again, because x's and z's will anti-commute. And so each time one of those happens, we get a minus 1. And so we have to add them all up and count the parity. And that's what this combination does, right? This px.qz goes through each of the bits and says, are they both 1? Right? And whenever it's yes, we add 1. And we're doing this addition modulo 2. All this is binary. Right? And then we do the same thing here. And if we get 0 at the end, then these two things commute. And if we get 1, they anti-commute. Does everyone see that? Yes? Should I do an example? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Okay, so let's take 3 qubits and let's look at this operator. So this will be P. And let's make Q this operator, Z, Z, Z. So what are the binary vectors, the 2n-bit binary vectors here? Well, for p, we have y is x times z. So the x vector is going to be 1, 1, 0. And the z vector, we only have this middle case. So we have 0, 1, 0. Right? In q, well, the x vector is always 0. We have 0, 0, 0. And the z vector, 1, 1, 1. OK? So do these two things commute or not? Well, how do we figure it out? Well, these two will anti-commute. So this gives us a minus 1. These two anti-commute, so that gives us another minus 1. And these two commute, so that gives us a plus 1. OK, so let's see how it works over here. Well, we have this vector dotted with this vector. So we have 1, 1 plus 1, 1 plus 0, 1. OK? And what that's saying is that, well, the x up here is anti-commuting with the z down here. Right? That's what this is saying. This is saying the y up here is anti-commuting with the z down here. OK? And this is saying that the I up here is commuting with the Z down there. So this gives us one part. And the other part is, well, it's going to all be 0, right? And if you add all these up, you'll see there's only two 1s. So we get, that's even, so we get 0. OK? So this allows us to go back and forth between this binary vector notation and the Pauli group without losing this important property that we need to say determine whether the stabilizer is allowed, whether it has to be an abelian group, and to determine whether we can detect errors. Okay, so now let's prove B. And to do that, I want to first state a lemma. So suppose we have some number of independent Pauli operators. And now I can actually, yeah.
Sorry, are we proving B in a different way, or?
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
A. Right. So now I can actually define very rigorously what I mean by independent. I mean that their binary vectors are linearly independent. So okay, suppose I have some number of these. For instance, the generators and stabilizer. It doesn't have to be that. I'm not even requiring that these things commute with each other. And some vector E. Which is S bits. Long. Then there exist n minus s independent, and again meaning that binary vectors are linearly independent, Pauli operators q such that, no, let's call these p sub I. Okay, so this is n minus s, and then we'll call them qj, but that's not really going to matter very much. I only kind of need to consider them one by one. It's like that pi dot qj, using a symplectic inner product, is equal to the ith bit of this vector e. In other words, given any S independent poly operators, I can choose another poly operator, in fact, a lot of other poly operators, that will commute or anti-commute with each one however I want. Right? So it could commute with the first two and then anti-commute with the third one, and then commute with the fourth one and then anti-commute with the rest, something like that. Okay? And we know by the arguments for part B above that, in fact, once we have this Q, or one of them, Q sub J, we can, well, okay, so, sorry, that's an application of the lemma. First, let me just, well, I'm not really going to prove this. But let me point out that the proof is very straightforward, because these equations are all linear equations using that expansion of the, what is it, of the symplectic interproduct, right? And we know just from linear algebra that if we have S independent linear equations, and the reason it's 2n is because there's 2n bit vectors, so it's a 2n dimensional binary vector. Anyway, if we have all of these linear equations, then there is going to be a solution. In fact, there's going to be a lot of independent solutions equal to the codimension, right? The size of the whole vector space, the dimension of the whole vector space, minus the number of equations. Okay, so that proves the lemma. And then given that, it's going to be pretty easy to prove this part A. But I guess I need a little more space. Sacrifice time to get good. Okay, so how do we do this? Well, so we have the stabilizer. And so in the lemma, these are going to be our PIs. Then we apply the lemma, and we say that given any error syndrome for the stabilizer, exists some poly operator which will have this pattern of commutation, anti-commutation. And remember by the argument, well, here, roughly, something that anti-commutes will take us to the appropriate eigenspace. So for any E, we can find a Q sub E such that PI dot QE is equal to PI. And so PI times psi is going to be, well, okay. So what we can do then is define some coset of the original stabilizer, S of E, to be generated by something very similar to the original stabilizer, P1 through PR, but instead we'll add a sign out front. So it'll be generated by minus 1 to the EI PI. Okay? So the point is, if before we had PI with a plus 1 eigenvalue, now we might have with a minus 1 eigenvalue if EI is 1 in that location. Okay? And we have all possible error synchros. And the point is that these are going to partition the space in some sense. So in particular, so Q sub E applied to psi is then going to be in T of S of E by the arguments I gave before, right? So when psi is in T of S. So if we have a state in the original code space that has plus 1 eigenvalues, we apply Q sub E that has these particular commutation, anti-commutation relations. We get a new state that has a different set of eigenvalues equal to the bits of these error synchros. Okay? I feel like I didn't explain that very well, but maybe you caught on anyway. I'd like some reaction. No, you didn't caught on. Catch on. Okay, so now that I've written it down, I can maybe say it and do it this way. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to take the states of the original code subspace, or that of all eigenvalue plus 1, and we'd like to map them to kind of a very similar code subspace, but with different eigenvalues. Okay? And the reason we can do this is by the lemma. We can find some operator that will commute or anti-commute with each of the generators and stabilizer in whatever pattern we choose. And we know from the arguments before that something that anti-commutes with a particular generator stabilizer will take us from the plus 1 eigenvalue of that stabilizer, plus 1 eigenstate, to a minus 1 eigenstate. Okay? So once we have this operator that has the right commutation, anti-commutation pattern, we can take ourselves from the plus 1 eigenspace to whatever eigenspace we like. Okay? Does that make sense now? Okay.
So in general, there are a number of these QEs, or?
Yeah, there's lots of them. But I think for this argument, we only need one. Well, one for each E. Okay, so once we've done this, we know, since these QEs are Pauli operators, in fact, that this is a unitary map. So the whole point of this argument, in fact, was just to show this one fact, that the dimension of this shifted subspace, the subspace that has different eigenvalues, is equal to the dimension of the original subspace. Okay? So whatever the eigenvalues are, the size of the subspace is not going to change. And then we just need one more observation, which is, well, we can use these projectors. Okay? So the projector onto S sub E is, well, it's like that, except we have these extra signs. 1 over 2 to the n minus k. I think this form is probably going to be easier. So we replace mi with minus 1 to the ei times mi. Sorry, I shifted the PIs, the generators. Right? So this is the projector just applying directly that formula. This is the projector onto the shifted subspace, S of E. And so what happens then if we sum over all these projector operators? So the point is, my claim is that these shifted subspaces will basically give us the whole space. So if we sum up the projector operators, Well, what happens? Let's look at the first thing. We get half the time we're going to get EI is equal to 0, and half the time we're going to get EI equals 1. And we can fix all of the, so let's start with E1. Let's fix E2 through ER. And let E1 be either 0 or 1. Right? Well, then we have, the other terms are all the same, so they all factor out. And so we have I plus PI plus I minus PI. So we just get 2 times I. And that's true for E1. We've gotten rid of E1 now and P1. And we can do the same thing then for P2 and P3 and P4. Right? So these signs will always cancel out because we have half the time we have 0 and half the time we have 1. So this sum here is then just 1. Okay? In other words, these projections partition the space. So this is saying that the direct sum over vectors E of these shifted subspaces is the whole Hilbert space. And therefore, the dimension of T of SE, since they're all the same, is equal to the dimension of the whole Hilbert space divided by the number of T to SEs. And how many of them are there? Well, it's the same as their number of E's. And E can be 0 or 1 for each of the R bits, so there's 2 to the R. And that was part A. That was what I wanted to show. Yeah?
Well, any of the definition of the direct sum?
Oh, so direct sum is you have two subspaces that intersect only at 0. Okay. And the direct sum is then the span of the subspaces, so any linear combination. So in other words, that any vector can be written as a linear combination of things that have some error syndrome, which, when I say it that way, is maybe kind of obvious. But this is just a proof of the obvious case. Or this part is just a proof of the obvious. That's why I could do it in 2 lines, whereas this required a little more. OK? Any other questions? Yeah?
Maybe you heard a word and I just missed it. But do we have a way to ensure that all those TSEs are all distinct?
So why do TSEs distinct? Well, I guess I didn't say this explicitly, but it kind of happens automatically because they have different eigenvalues for these operators, right? And so a state can't have both +1 eigenvalue and -1 eigenvalue for the same operator. So therefore, either the space is 0, which is ruled out by this possibility, or they're distinct. I guess it could be 0. Well, yeah. So it can't be 0 because R has to be less than equal to N. So. They would all have to be 0. OK. So maybe that's a good place to stop. We'll take a 5-minute break or so and return, and I'll talk about some more kinds of stabilizer codes.